Radio Espial is a series of podcasts brought to you across the internet by TIPM Media. Presented by investigative journalist Mick Rooney, it covers a host of topics from international media, publishing, aviation, and technology. Thank you for listening to this podcast today.
Welcome to episode 4 of Radio Espial, and we have another great guest lined up for you. Let's take it away. Tonight it's writing, publishing, media and politics. I'll introduce you to our guest very shortly. Okay, you're very welcome to episode 4 of Radio Espial's podcast. Podcast and videocast. Let's get straight on and tell you about my guest today. Linda Riesenberg-Feisler began working at Procter & Gamble in 1979 and graduated from high school. Linda's career started as a technician working in the physical properties lab testing toilet paper. No sniggering at the back, she will explain all that. During her 26 years at the company, computer technology was in the early stages and Linda's interest and assignments naturally migrated to this area, with assignments from representing business requirements of computer systems to developing the technology needed by the users. Linda was one of a small number of non-college graduates promoted to management. Linda's imagination and love for writing and creating were never far from her mind and her hands. Feeling stymied and hindered in the corporate world, she resigned from Procter & Gamble in 2006 to pursue a more creative way of life. She always wrote from childhood to present day. In 2015, after discovering a rejected Star Trek The Next Generation script she had sent to Gene Roddenberry, she organised the hundreds of scenes previously written into her first novel. Blind Influence was published initially by an author solutions service. Linda also teaches oil painting and previously worked for Kevin MacPherson between 2006 and 2009. MacPherson is an internationally known master artist. Linda also is the producer and host of a podcast called Art Chat. She interviews master artists of today, exploring the skills needed to become a successful artist. Linda completed her first trilogy of the Blind series. Blind Influence is a three-time award-winning novel. It was followed by the award-winning Blind Persuasion and recently launched Blind Alliance. Being an artist, Linda enjoys designing her book covers, self-publishing her work from formatting to marketing. She is currently working on the second trilogy in the series. It's influenced by John Jakes, Robert Lundrum and Aaron Sorkin. Linda's interest in politics and history plays an important role in her work. The premise for the Blind series, set in the 1980s, revolves around one question. I find this fascinating and it'll play into our, particularly our later part of the interview. Listen to this. Can one politician, a female lawyer and an MI6 agent make decisions that divert us from the divisiveness that engulfs the world today? Let's go and talk to Linda. Okay, and Linda joins us now. Linda, you're very welcome to Radio Spoil.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun, Mick. We talk a lot on, talk a lot on Facebook, and I'm sure we'll get into a lot of interesting topics. So
I can imagine. We certainly will. Linda, I like with all the guests I've had on, I'm sure you recently listened to the last episode we had with Mark Levine on, and we talked an awful lot about publishing and self-publishing, and I suppose the whole indie author area. That's obviously going to be a major part of our discussion today. But like all my guests, I like to just, helps the audience just to introduce you to. So we're going to start really, we're going to go far back, right? Back to the beginning.
Oh, let's not get into the age thing. That's not...
No, never ask anyone, a man or a woman, at their age. Let's step back a bit. You're from the U.S.
Yes, I am. Grew up about 30 miles south of where I currently am in Ohio. So, there was nothing special about my childhood. Typical thing. Had a bunch of friends in the neighborhood.
There was no politicians or rock stars in the family.
Daryl Pace.
See, here we go.
Yeah, Daryl Pace. I don't know if anybody knows Daryl Pace, but he was a gold medal winner in the Olympics for archery back when I was a kid. So he was kind of our only, oh my God, it's Daryl Pace type of thing in our little town. But
Mark was telling us as well that his father also attempted to qualify and came marginally very, very close to actually qualifying as a runner in the Olympics for the US. So, yeah, it's always fascinating with families. And actually, that's something else as we talk about our early upbringing and how it influences in what we do in life. In a much later episode, we'll actually be talking about family and ancestry because I know it's a fascinating thing for people.
Right.
So, Ohio, you grew up in, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, right below the Great Lakes, in case folks are wondering where it is. But when I was we went on a trip to France, my husband and I, and whenever they asked us where we were, I would say Ohio, and then they'd look at us kind of strange, and I go, just somewhere in the middle. They know where California is, they know where New
They do,
York
they
is, but
know,
they
you know
never,
you, and
yeah.
maybe Florida, and vaguely
Yeah,
maybe where Canada is, that's that bit above America.
right. Yeah, so basically, with childhood, the only thing that I kind of pertains to what our talk is today is I kind of grew up writing. As I always say, most kids, their parents give them crayons and a coloring book, and everybody's coloring in the little shapes and everything. And I'm the one that's writing gibberish, trying to write letters instead of coloring things in and making up a story for the whole page. So.
So you were kind of a sort of by teenage years, you were sort of a kind of a budding Anna Frank.
I never did a diary. I thought it was more fun
Yeah.
to be imaginative.
Yeah.
So I always made up stories and always wrote scripts for my favorite TV shows that I was watching at the time, and just a bunch of dialogue and everything. We put on shows. When the VHS camera came out, that was probably our most fun because we would write spoofs of different shows and then we would record them on the VHS camera. That really dates me, but that was our Saturday night, our Saturday afternoons into Saturday night fun that we used to do in the neighborhood. So always had a background for writing, always did a background for film and things like that. Always wanted to do that.
Now, Linda, so the writing bug was there from an early stage, but
Absolutely.
as all those writers who want to do it full time, we quickly realize that it's not kind of like the easiest and best career to get into if you want to make it your living, as it
Right.
were, roof and food on the table kind of living.
Right.
So we kind of end up for a time in our lives doing other things, and you sort of started off doing some other interesting things. So tell me a little bit about the sort of the career and the boring working life before I really got to what I wanted to do.
Really. It was kind of, there's a thing that happened with my folks, which I will share. My brother, let's go back a little bit. You talked a little bit about genealogy. My dad was actually the baby of nine siblings, and he was the only one that finished college or finished high school. So when my brother graduated, who's 5 years older than me, he went on to college. I graduated, and my parents asked me where I wanted to go to school, and I said USC, and dad said, I have no idea where that is. And I said, Southern Cal, and I want to go for film. And he's like, that ain't happening. So you can go to UC, which is University of Cincinnati. And I was like, nope, that they don't have film. So what I ended up doing was basically working at Procter and Gamble, and started out in the physical test lab where we tested toilet paper. So and when I say that, everybody just kind of gets this look on their face like,
And how
oh my
did you
God.
do that? How did you go
Yeah,
through
because you know where you go, right? You go to
that?
that bathroom scene, and that's not what we did. But it's always a good joke. Always gets a good joke because I say I didn't literally test toilet paper. But so tensile strength, the strength of the paper, flushability, things like that's what we did. So did that for about 8 years, and really felt the creativity and everything being sucked out of my body the more I did that. But the good thing is on breaks and on lunch, and then I had these writing marathons all weekend where I basically would come home from work on Friday night and just start writing till about 3 or 4 in the morning, crash out for a few hours and continue to write. But none of that really, at that time, we're talking the only way you really could publish was with a publishing house. So you had to find an agent, you had to write letters, you had to do a number of things to try and get published, to try and get their eye more or less. So publishing world was really different than it is today, back then. Worked at Procter & Gamble for 26 years, had back surgery about 6 months before I left. I came back from that, and I was working in a field where I would be reporting to engineers, and there weren't a lot of women engineers back then, so there was a lot of male engineers. They all went to college. Some of them went to Ivy League schools. So there was a bit of a struggle, if you want to call it that, where, you know, the real superiority complex, if you want to say that, kind of came through. You know, being told that I didn't have a thinking process at one point in the career, it was just really kind of, you know, interesting. So after about 26 years, I was hired in as a technician, which is non-management. And after 23 years, I had a really fantastic manager who went to bat for me. I had actually been doing the job of a manager for years before that, but he actually went to the bat for me and promoted me to management, got me promoted. And I was probably one in a handful of people that they ever promoted to management without a college degree. So I was pretty proud of that. Feet. And it was really kind of interesting too, because the HR director, when he hired me, asked me where I saw myself 5 years after being hired. And I told him managing people and managing projects. And he said, it'll never happen because I don't have a college degree. And, you know, so I proved him wrong. So I had accomplished what I wanted to do there and was ready to move.
I suppose you ask, I mean, I can think back to the time, 10, maybe more than 10 years ago, where I kind of also made that step out of what we, I mean, obviously it's not the same for everybody, what we'd call that sort of 9 to 5 routine. And I sort of remember the trepidate, the excitement, but the fear, you know, the trepidation of making that move and thinking, am I doing the right thing? And can I do the right thing? And is it fair for everybody around me to make this decision? Was there a moment for you when you went, this is now enough of this, and I've got to give the writing a go. I've really got to start to focus on that as something more than just writing when I come home.
Well, back in the 90s, I had started painting, and we'll talk about the painting aspects of my life later. But I really knew that I had to get out and start doing something more creative, more in line with what I wanted to do before I actually started working at Procter & Gamble. So it's never really left me. Like I said, I wrote all during that time.
Sure.
Imaginary things and scenes for a book that I ever wanted to publish and ended up publishing. But, you know, there was P&G made it kind of easy for me to decide that it was time to leave. And that I didn't have children. It's just my husband and I and my parents. My mother had passed about 4 years prior to that. And my dad had Alzheimer's, and it was getting to the point where he was going to start needing a lot more attention and help. And I came back from having back surgery, and it found out that they had, without any legal issues here, but you know, that they basically downrated me while I was out on disability, kind of, you know, not the right thing to do. So at that point it was kind of like, do I really want to keep fighting for this? I mean, it was a constant fight, and I just, you know, I have a very understanding and lovable and support and loving husband. And he just basically said, give me 6 months and we'll get our finances in order and you can walk out. And that's what I did.
Okay.
So, did
you just give me a decade when we are? Because I'm just trying to get my head around what publishing the world would have been in that decade. Are we 80s, 90s?
No, 2006.
Okay, so things had significantly come on. It was very much a different world. This wasn't the publishing world, I suppose, of the... We talked a little bit about this with Mark as well. This wasn't, to remind our listeners who haven't heard that program, this wasn't the publishing world where in the 70s and 80s and even up to the 90s, you could still, as an author without an agent, directly approach quite a number of publishers. And an awful lot of that has changed now. Now there's that brick wall called, you know, agents that you've got to go through. Most publishers won't even entertain you. You know, if you want to approach them. So you've kind of got a two-layered process before you even have a chance to get on an editor's table. And I suppose it's the first thing that most authors, it's the road that they look initially to go down. That's kind of slightly changing now, you know, in the 2000s. But even up to the late 1990s, it was still... And I think I've always said this, that I don't know, let's get your thoughts on it, but I've always found that actually in some kind of way, almost like a discipline, there is some method and madness and sense in also trying to go down initially that road, no matter whether you're successful or not. There are some benefits. Just give me your thoughts
Right.
on that.
But yeah, I mean, I personally have not gone down that road, but that's a personal choice that I have made. There are times when I start to say, well, maybe I should start looking to see if I can find an agent. I'm on my fourth book, I'm starting to build the author platform. So yeah, I mean, I'm questioning if I should start doing that because I have some content that I can actually put in front of them that they might be interested in. I didn't initially go down that track because I didn't, without having something published, without having a bit of a, number of people who want to read my books and no experience in that area, I didn't think that I'd had a really big chance. And I wrote a couple agents and things like that, and of course got the rejections that you normally get. And I just thought, there's nothing really stopping me from going ahead and doing this on my own. So yeah, so
So
I think
let's
that's
let could
it.
be let's explain because obviously we have a viewership today and some of them will be into writing maybe are thinking about going down the publishing line haven't really explored it. So I suppose maybe for them the first question they're asking is well hang on if you don't go to publishers and you don't go to agents and you can't and that's very difficult to do and that takes ages and you mightn't be successful then hang on a second then sure well what other way is there but there isn't any way
Well, there's a couple different ways, and what I ended up doing is I found Ally, which you're a member of, the Alliance of Independent Authors, and
Terrific organization to support authors who maybe and both kind of authors who want to go down the traditional way, but many of those members also have gone the other way, and this is what we're going to talk about, self-publishing and being an indie author.
And basically, I was starting to learn a lot about self-publishing through Ally, but I really wanted to get that first book out there. I was being really impatient. So I ended up going to a little vanity press with my eyes open, which is different than some people do. You sign up for like Author Solutions or this happened to be Dog Ear Publishing, and it was a great group. I met with them for 2 hours beforehand. I had all the questions that I needed to ask and wanted to make sure that I can retain the rights to my book. Wanted to make sure there was no problem if I canceled the contract after we published. So the thing that I was light on at that time was formatting and cover design and you could probably still argue that I'm still, need a little more experience in that area. But, what I wanted to do is I wanted to get that book out, and I wanted to take the time when Dog Ear was publishing my book and working with me to actually learn how to do this myself. So I took the pressure of publishing my first book off of me, paid them the contract, the money to do it, and I told them up front, after this is published a certain amount of time, I am probably going to cancel our contract. And they were like, that's no problem. We were very upfront with one another. And I did probably about 3 or 4 months after that, cancel the contract with them, because basically, when you enter that contract, you end up with like 50% of the book royalties going to them, I guess, and then 40% to the distribution agent, and you end up basically with a dollar or two on every sale. And like we have always said, they, like some of the publishing houses, unless you're a big name, you don't get a lot of marketing. So you had to learn how to market your own book as well. So, I thought, well, I'm doing all this work. Why am I giving them all the money? So I just kind of, we ended that contract. And by that time, I had learned enough to publish my second book basically all on my own. I did the cover design,
And
I
that's
did the
really
format.
that's I suppose if we just explain to people, the choices I suppose you have is you can go to, a multiple of we won't start dropping names and of there but essentially anybody who's explored self-publishing or literally has gone to Google and stuck in self-publishing, you'll get a multitude of author solutions owned companies. You'll get companies like Mill City Press. You'll get Dog Ear. You'll get Matador. You'll get and but like anything in life, not all companies are equal, in a sense of
Okay, Mick, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Your picture's just frozen there. We'll just bear for a second and see. Does it just pick up? And I'll just keep talking. Yeah. So you've got a multitude of different companies and different, I suppose that offer different quality and different terms. And I suppose essentially then, the other side of it is like you having had that experience of working 6 months, 12 months, having a book out. Then you go, is there a better way to do this? And that's, I suppose, when you really, as a self-published author, start to become your own manager of the project rather than paying somebody or handing out the management process. You actually take that on board and you. Okay, sorry, we just had a connection problem there for a few moments, but we have Linda back with us. Yeah, Linda, so just on the we were talking about the other side of self-publishing, instead of going to some a company as such to do it for you, that essentially you start contracting out, whether it's a designer, a book designer, whether it's a formatter, a marketeer. But so talk to us about that process a little from your perspective, and how you found it in comparison to somebody else doing it for you.
Yeah, it's Ally helped a lot, and basically I knew at that point that I would need an editor for sure. So trying to find an editor became an issue. Book formatting, there's a lot of helpful information out at CreateSpace. They have actual templates that you can use, and that's basically where I went for my second book and my third book actually. And then as far as cover design, there are a number of freelance cover editors out there. I mean, Fiverr was one place. Another author friend of mine went to Fiverr and found somebody. I basically decided that since I'm also an artist, that I wanted to do my own. So then it became a search for software, and I ended up using Adobe. I think it's ID is the little thing that's by the box, the creative thing. So, and it has directions and instructions on how to create a book cover, front, back, and spine out on CreateSpace, step-by-step instructions on how to do that. So since a lot of my work career was around computers as well, designing computer systems and bringing business requirements and things like that, I didn't have a fear of computers, so decided to tackle a lot of that myself. But one thing I wouldn't tackle is editing. I still have an editor that I send my work to, because another set of eyes is really, really good.
Right,
But
and
I
it's isn't it? It's a major thing that, from doing my own consultancies with authors, usually at an early stage, I try to get an understanding of, because every author, no matter what their skills are, there's some skill set that they can bring to the project. But I think the crucial thing is understanding and accepting that you're going to find there are certain parts of it, whether it's the editing, whether it's the marketing, whether it's the formatting, whether it's the designs, somewhere, it's not that you can learn those skills over time, but ultimately, if you're coming to it for the first time, you've got to kind of like acknowledge that there are certain areas that you're not going to be able to do, and it's probably not advisable to attempt to do it, because ultimately, that book has to be of the standard that any book is going to be from any major publisher. And if it isn't, the reader's going to quickly spot that the editing's poor or the design looks awful, and they're crucial things.
And exactly what you said around cover design. I'm very, very artistic, so my covers are totally different than what other book covers are. And that's another thing I'm questioning right now is like, do I need to go back and redesign the covers on these? But being an artist, mine are very artful and are not what you would consider an industry standard. And then there's also a part of me that says, this is me. I want to put this out this way. And I've had a lot of great feedback on, gee, can I have a poster of this because it's so pretty? And I sell to a lot of artists, so they appreciate the cover. So, we there's things that you have to decide what you're going to take a hit on, what you're not going to take a hit on. I have a really, really good editor. The first book that I sent her was actually more than what we had agreed to for her to do on the book and editing. So I ended up paying her a little extra because I didn't feel like I misrepresented what we were doing, but we certainly had a disconnect in what the book needed. So felt a little bad about that. So be aware of that too, because there is language and vocabulary that you need to learn along the way as well. So copy editing and, you know, a full edit are totally different things.
Content editing, yeah. Content editing, yeah. You need to understand what level of, and ultimately, I think when you go to a professional editor, and really, if you decide that you need assistance, I think it's important as well, isn't it, to go to a professional who does that. You know, I mean, yeah, for example, as you say, the artwork that you've done, because that's been a sphere of your life, and that's one of your great skills. But I have so many people who say, well, you know, for the editing, my tutor in college says they can edit the book, and I'm going, no, your tutor in college might be the most eloquent and articulate, you know, man or woman that you've ever met, but they are not a professional editor. And a professional editor can understand where the work is when it's initially passed to them, and what level it needs to be, and what kind of editing they can appraise and you know, give that work. And I suppose it goes to, you know, everything else. Well, you know, my cousin is kind of handy on computers, so I've decided that he's going to do the formatting. Yeah, right. Okay, let's see how that goes. So, you know, it is important that you assess your project, and that it's your project and you should be proud of it.
Right.
But when you hand it over, that you're handing it over into professional hands. And it's if you don't have the financial investment to do that, then sometimes it's better just to improve all the other areas, and then when you're ready, then, you know, go for it and do it.
Yeah, and one area, Nick, that I'd like to get your input on is, I used to do a little self-publishing group. We used to get together on Thursday evenings and talk about self-publishing, and I really think there's, this is my opinion, I really think there is a misrepresentation of what to expect of beta readers in your book. I mean, I have a lot of people that are skipping, that were in my group, that were skipping editing because they would put it out to 9 beta readers to read and reply to. And I think beta readers are great for content of story and storyline and finding out where where some holes may be that you need to fill. But I don't particularly think they're editors, unless you happen to have a really good friend who is a really professional, really good professional editor. Then I don't have a big as issue with it. But, you know, and the interesting thing with that went through that, to take the one step further, they were saying, you know, I can't seem to get books into bookstores.
Yeah.
And I was like, because you haven't had it professionally edited, you know.
Yeah.
Seemed to always be the
first
question.
On the beta readers, I suppose it works differently for different authors. My approach would be, really, you know, as you say, your beta readers are not your editor, and maybe to go to that stage, that really should happen before you pay $1,000 to a professional editor to edit it.
Right.
Really, the beta readers should be looking at the book, and as you say, should be looking at that plot line there on chapter 3 that you introduced. That doesn't make sense, or I don't find that believable, or do you know what? I'll be honest, I started to lose a little bit of interest halfway through the book, or the ending was a bit disappointing, not whether it's good or bad, but just it didn't quite make sense, or it didn't quite add up. Or, you know, you're describing this as a fantasy science fiction book, but, you know, I've read plenty of sci-fi books, and this didn't really strike me as that. It's like more a sort of an urban book, you know, it's not quite, you know, so that's where I think the beta readers and the mom and dad, cousin, brother, granny, you know, who reads the book can be helpful. But please don't use that core of people to actually edit your book. You introduce them when you go the end at your manuscript and go, that's as much as I can do now. Now I go to the next stage of developing it and identifying if there's something wrong with it, if it doesn't read right, if it something doesn't work with it. And then when you feel that you've got all that concept done and it is now, you've got the feedback, then
In other words, don't mix beta readers up with the bottom end reviewers who are assisting and maybe helping you to get a bit of kudos to get books into bookstores, real bookstores, or get it to the attention of people. So don't use it
Right.
backwards. That's what I'll say on beta readers.
Yeah. I think we both kind of agree on that one. So, and you made a good point too. I mean, I have never spent less than $1,000 on editing. I mean, my editor, any professional editor will give you their background. All you have to do is ask, and tell you what you do. And anybody who can't provide that background,
And any editor as well who's professional knows that part of the role in working with a client, because it's a client relationship, is that
Exactly.
you offer that up. You say, look, I'll edit the first 5 or 10 pages. You can take a look, see what the process might be like. If you're happy with it, fine. Or here's the names of authors or books that I've worked with. You can get a good feel of this is their finished work. You can go, well,
Right.
that read well. Yeah, this sounds like this. Rather than, because it's an important relationship and it's fundamental. If that relationship doesn't work on your self-published book and it goes wrong and you're not happy with the work being done, then you've got to question the whole project and moving it on until you fix that part. So it's a really important relationship. Probably it's the most important relationship. And I threw out that $1,000 figure, really. I mean, that would be, quite frankly, that would be for a reasonably light sort of edit. That wouldn't be any kind of a serious, certainly getting into content editing or serious back and forths over a month or two of a project. Believe me, if any editor was a was doing 2 or 3 months' work on a book, and they were charging an author $1,000. I don't think they'd be in business too long.
No, I don't either. So that's, and that's one of the reasons why I said if I was going to, skimp anywhere, little quotation marks around the word skimp, it would be more on the cover design and the because I can do that. I feel comfortable doing that. And and quite honestly, at some point, if a publisher decides that they want to take me on as a client and I want to enter into that contract with a big publishing house or whatever, they're going to redo my covers anyway. So, so that the cover to me wasn't as important as editing. And again, that's me. That's the way I think. And so after I put all the book together, I sell it up through CreateSpace and Amazon. And there are a whole school, there's a whole another conversation we can get around with exclusive to Amazon, or do you want to be out on as many platforms as are out there, like Nook and Kobo and all the other
For ebooks now,
self-publishing, for ebooks. And then I go through another edit, basically as a copy edit. I order a proof. I don't put it out until I go through that book. I order a couple proofs actually, and then my husband reads it, goes through and finds errors because there are still errors, even though you had edited. I found a lot of errors after that that I
And
didn't
the fact
catch.
is that goes for not just self-published work, but how many,
Publishing houses, yeah.
heavy, large publishing houses have put out books. Few books are absolutely 100% when they hit the stalls.
It was. I read recently a book by Larry. You may know him, Ty. I think it is TYE. He wrote the Bobby Kennedy book.
Oh yeah, yes, yeah.
And I was reading through that, and I was really impressed because I got like halfway through the book before I found the typo. And unfortunately, it was one of these ones that made me go back and read the page because it was a date. They were off by a year, and the same date was three paragraphs above. So that kind of made me feel better as an independent
Yeah.
author that big mistake, made it out. But it's still, still a mistake. I keep wondering how many times they get emails from folks going on page 120, because I get emails. So,
And I suppose
but.
the other aspect of it is as well that I find, obviously, you're in the US, I'm in the Netherlands. Another frustrating thing self-publishers find as well is all books, and it's something obviously to consider at the editing stage, is essentially
where you're publishing your book. Obviously, an ebook can go to multiple global markets, but essentially, a writer is writing in either American English or they're writing in what we call British English. And of course, that's different. And the amount of frustration I get back from authors who say, you know, that fucking so-and-so wrote an awful review of my book on Amazon. And all the errors and stuff they pointed out was the fact that my book is in British English because I'm a British citizen and, you know, that was where my initial audience is and they don't see that. And I find it fascinating because I suppose it's partly because a large publishing houses tend to sell books by territory. So there's the American English book for the North American audience, and then of course they sell the territorial rights for, you know, British English, whether it's Australia or the UK, you know, or Ireland or whatever. But yeah, it just came to me, you know, another frustrating thing that self-publishers come across, which other authors don't seem to come across. But then they have the benefit of a large publishing house of being able to produce, you know, different versions of a book.
There may be a couple folks I know in self-publishing that actually are starting to do that themselves as well. I have not done that. I'm kind of at the beginning of my author career here, so it's so I haven't done that, but yeah, that certainly would be a big issue. And the interesting thing is when you were talking, as I realized that I have a number of British fans who have read my book, and I guess because they're used to me, they talk with me and all that. They know it's in American English and not British English.
I suppose that really takes us on because, you know, you're an author. Tell us about your books. Tell us what you write about.
I started down this path back when I was working at Procter and Gamble, as I said earlier, and it's basically the tagline that I came up with is kind of like Jason Bourne meets The Good Wife in The West Wing. So it's a mystery espionage, and it has a lot of political intrigue in it. And basically, it's three characters, one female, two males, an MI6 agent, a female lawyer, and then a politician here in the United States. And it basically goes back to asking a question of, if we were able to do something different back in 1980s, in the 1980s, would we be where we are today politically? So it's set in history and
Exactly, because the book, now I know one of them is set in, is it the 1980s, but are they all set in the 1980s or did they
yeah.
move? Okay, they're all so just for people, and we'll have all the links or wherever people find this podcast or video cast. It's called the Blind Series. So there's Blind Influence, Blind Persuasion, and Blind Alliance.
That's correct.
Talk to me a little bit about the challenges that an author has when they have to set, and we'll take as for example your books in the 1980s, because it seems to me that that's really, because here we are in 2017, that's got to be still the same challenge as setting a book, whether it's in the 1980s or 1880s. The challenges are still the same to understand, well, what was going on there politically, technically, what was going on, which is a fundamental thing, because, you know, how often do you say, how the hell did that, you know, you're talking about a mobile phone in the 1980s, you know, or you know. So just tell us about the challenges of that for an author.
Well, you hit on it right away, because in the 1980s, the early 1980s, computers weren't really commercially available
A
at
household
that
thing,
time.
yeah.
And the only phone you had was one that was hardwired into the wall. So if, you know, Sean or Nicole need to call someone, they have to physically walk to a phone and find a phone booth or to a phone and call. They can't just whip out their cell phones. So, you know, and I lived, you know, I'm living this time. So, you know, I keep going back to, you know, okay, in 1980, did I have a computer in 1980? No, I didn't. So that's one of the things. But one of the reasons why I call it the Blind Series is because there are so many really little things that we didn't know about that influenced us through that time period. Like, there's an Operation Mockingbird that the CIA had going on, and it's explained in the book. And, you know, that really had a lot of influence on people, because basically Operation Mockingbird was a propaganda tool for the CIA, where they were basically paying journalists to get their story out. And it was kind of a counter terrorism, if you want to call it counterterrorism, but you could. in these days, since we use that phrase rather a lot. But, you know, on the other side in the FBI was J. Edgar Hoover with all of his files. And, you know, whenever somebody needed some information, it always seemed to be going to J. Edgar Hoover's file to get it or whatever. And the CIA got a little upset with that and basically started Operation Mockingbird. And that part of the fictional book is true. So I explain a little bit about Operation Mockingbird, but then I use it fictionally, if you will, with one of my characters. So it was interesting when you go back and you do all this research and you find these little projects that are now coming to light because it's been, you know, so many years later, 40 some years later. And these things are starting to come up and you're like, wow, you know, that really could have influenced us at the time. And our decisions as a electorate, as a citizen of any country, you know, so yeah, there's a lot of research that goes in. I always find myself when I'm writing, taking questions, asking myself like, okay, I'm going to have this person like hop on a train. Well, no, wait, what was the train schedule back then? You know, what time of day would it be? Would they be able just to hop on a train or would they be waiting in the station? And a lot of different questions like that come up. What kind of car is it? What kind of car model is it? You know, what did it look like?
It is a huge amount of research. You must have.
It is.
You must have, well, if not real files, inches thick of, and that's my file about cars around that time. That's a file about, you know, domestic appliances that were available that you could buy at the time and to use them. That's my file on what people ate and what they did.
Exactly. And it's really interesting, too, because when just the difference in researching the book when I first started writing it. I mean, one of the reasons why I kept it in the 1979, I kick it off in November of 79. And it goes up to about January of 1981 is the first trilogy. That's the time that it covers. And, you know, when I started researching this book back in 1979, 1980, I was going to a library and pulling out information and spending lots and lots of times at a library. And I still do some of that. But, you know, most of my library stuff now, thank God, is on the internet. So I get to find a lot of different things.
People probably under the age of I don't know, 20, 15, I don't want to offend anybody, but probably going, what's a library?
And that's sad
because people don't actively go out, okay, if there maybe there's a college library or there's a municipal library in their area, but essentially it's not a daily or a weekly practice now. Well, we all remember with the little tickets, you know, that you had.
Index cards.
Yeah. you know, you hand the ticket over, got stamped, and then you took your book, and then you brought it back, and the lady or the guy there said, you owe us 50 cents because this was due back last Monday, not this Monday.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah,
the internet has changed so much of that now. As researchers, as readers, and as how we consume all of the things we consume now in what we read and watch.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when, I mean, just the difference in searching the internet has changed in the last 10 years so dramatically. I mean, I can remember when the internet first came online and trying to search, you had to have almost the exact word search to match what you were looking for. And now you can type in a question and you get, you know, hundreds and thousands of answers. I mean, that was totally different. So in a way, it's kind of scary because if all of that went away, would the generations after us really be able to figure out what they needed to do?
Yeah, if they were researching a book on life in the 2020s, what the hell were they doing then?
Right,
to me a little bit then, if we look at, because the internet has not only changed publishing, how we publish, you know, how we read, how we consume, but just before we move from the books and the writing, just reflect back before we close out this part of the discussion on how the internet for you as a writer has impacted on marketing and the marketing of your books and how you use it now.
Yeah, you know, social media is great because you learn to use hashtags to help do it. I actually use it to post teasers for the book that I have coming out soon. And also in some of the marketing of the books that are already out, I'll post a teaser of it and, you know, ask the question, you know, what do you think's going to happen here? And I've actually, the internet has, well, connected you and I, for example.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even known you were over there in Amsterdam if it wasn't for the internet. And, you know, I've actually have a lot of international contacts that I wouldn't have if it wasn't for the internet. So marketing that way, you know, making those connections is very, very helpful. You know, there's a ton of companies that are out there that you can put your book out with. There are a ton of, you know, firms that are out there doing, small companies that are out there doing book tours, for example, blog tours, that you can market through. There are people that are doing podcasts that you can, you know, go on and talk about your books about. So there's all kinds of opportunities to market yourself that you can look up and find on the internet, you know, and organizations, associations like Ally and a number of writing organizations, thrill writers and things like that, that have a lot of information for you to look up and ways that you can market your book. Now, you know, having said that, you know, like there's Facebook ads and there's, you know, Twitter ads and there's Amazon ads and things like that. You know, you have to redefine what you're looking for when you're doing that, because just because you spend a couple hundred dollars on a Facebook ad doesn't result in double that in book sales.
Absolutely.
At least for me. So you know, it might for Stephen King, but it doesn't for, you know, us lesser known authors. So you have to understand that what you're doing with that is you're just trying to raise awareness that you're out there, and spend accordingly, because you're not going to, you know, it's not going to absolutely result in book sales right off. So you need to have
it's,
other
it's part of building the author platform. And you know,
right.
I've consulted with some authors, and I know it's you know, boots for certain ground. And some authors will say to me, "Oh, you know, I'm not really keen on social media." And when we're specifically discussing marketing, and I'll say, with a deep breath, "Okay, but you know, now you're really making this, you know,
difficult. This is going to be difficult.
Difficult, yeah.
Yeah, and I sort of say, well, okay. Then you maybe need to consider, you know, more traditional forms of marketing,
right.
What we call older style marketing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the difference with social media marketing and old style marketing is that, you know, old style marketing is logos, taking out, you know, TV, radio sponsorship, is taking out, you know, ads in magazines, and that is what some big publishers do, but they also mix it with social media. But that's
right.
Where you need your $50,000, $100,000,
right.
You know, package, you know, to invest. And of course, most authors, even traditional authors, don't have that kind of, you know, spare income to throw it a book marketing project.
Right, right. You know, I one of the things that I'm at the position of is looking at how to be, you know, get awareness out there that I am an author and that I have books out there. I've got 3 books out there. It's not that, you know, like I'm doing this on my first book.
Yeah.
I did a lot of, you know, if you want to call it free stuff, to get for my first book, like giveaways and things like that to get attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, quickly found out that I was getting emails from people, which I love, that basically are saying, you know, when's the second book going to be ready? And I'm like, you know, 3,000 words into writing my second book. So yeah, it's going to be a while. So, and I really, you know, I am in awe of folks who can put books, you know, more than one book out a year. And it usually takes me a year with all the research that I have to do historically, and then the writing, the free write, and going on into the whole process of putting the book together with plot points and things like that. So I do a huge free write of just scenes. And then at some point, you know, I do a sketchy outline at the beginning saying this is where I kind of want it to go. I went, like, for my second trilogy that I'm working on now, I had to find that one piece of history that I wanted to use as the thread through this whole trilogy. And that took me probably 3 months to find. And then I found it, And I said, okay, now I have to write this. I wrote this real loose outline of how I wanted the trilogy to go. And now I'm in what I call the free write, where I'm up to about 78,000 words, and I'm just writing scenes, you know. And then from there, I will go back and write my actual outline for each book and start to pull that together. So I'm still probably 6 months away from starting my first trilogy book, and getting that one out there. But I'm hoping that if I do this full free write over the whole trilogy, that I'll be able to get the books out, you know, quicker. And since I have the first trilogy already out, you know, there I have to take time to market that. So it's an interesting dilemma, but it's fun. But it's fun. I mean, you have to like doing this.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. It's like a career in writing, and if you're anyway successful, and even if you're only moderately successful, or you're just doing it, you know, you're doing it for the passion because you love doing it. If you don't,
right.
You know, you can't write just for the sake of writing. You know, if you don't understand your audience, the passion and the love of doing what you do.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, I was, talking with someone and they were saying, you know, do you write every day? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, 'cause I love to.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's how many words do you write? And it's anywhere from, you know, if it's an hour or two, you know, I go anywhere from 1,000 words to, you know, up to 5,000 or 6,000 words a day, depending on how much time I have. And then, you know, like in all honesty, something may happen where I don't get to write the next day. You know, I usually tack on that word count. So that's why I usually end up with the 6,000 word count, is because I hadn't been able to write a lot and wanted to catch up. So, so it's a matter of scheduling. I mean, there is a discipline here. You have to have that discipline to make it happen. Otherwise, you're walking around going, yeah, I'll get to that writing later. You know, it never happens. But you have to treat it like a job. You know, I have X amount of hours a day that I spend researching and writing, and that hopefully pays off in a really great book. So
the other passion, of course, in your life is the visual arts.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Talk to me about that, how that all happened. You know, we're almost going back to Ohio now when you were younger.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was working at P&G. It was the 1990s. Yeah. And, you know, as everybody, when you work for corporate America or the 9-to-5 jobs, you know, they're paying you for 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
And at P&G, they're actually paying you for 40 hours a week, but expecting more like, I'm not picking on P&G, but any big corporation, you know, they pay you for 40, but expect you to work 60.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think that's uncommon. I'm watching my nephews and nieces and battling with their, you know, companies and how much time. But I really got away from being creative during the late 80s into the 90s, and there was a lot of pressure on my performance at that particular company. So I found a little way to become creative, and that was I found an art center that was giving out painting lessons that you paid for, and 2 hours a week every Thursday night I went to paint an oil painting. And so that really started to interest me, and it was a creative outlet. At that time, I wasn't writing as much. If I was writing, it was typically technical writing at work. And by the time I got home, my brain was so fried, I couldn't think about it. But Thursday nights, every Thursday night for 2 hours, I allowed myself to be creative. And that was my creative outlet, was painting, oil painting. So in 2006, when I resigned, I actually started working for one of the master artists that's known internationally. His name's Kevin McPherson. I became his assistant and was helping him on the business side, and he was helping me, mentoring me on my art. And that's when I started, actually, when I left P&G, I started thinking that I could make a living being an artist. Mm-hmm. But there is some commonality between being an artist and being an author, and that is, you know, it's very, very hard to break through, and it's very, very hard to make that a living. So, you know, when I was working with Kevin, it worked out really, really well. We started a little internet company called Artist Mentors Online, where we were mentoring other artists on a website, through a website. We would have lessons for them. They would paint the lessons, and then Kevin would critique them, and I was in charge of building the website and putting content out. So my writing turned from writing fiction to actually writing blog content for our artists that were part of that. And so, you know, I was best of both worlds, actually. I was painting, I was getting mentored by Kevin for my art, to learn about my art, which in turn I ended up writing blogs about, which was helpful to other artists. So it was an interesting time, and that lasted to about 2009 or so. And then Kevin and I kind of went in different directions, which is typical when you're, you know, an artist. So he kind of reinvented himself and got very, very interested in portraiture. And so he's kind of went that way. And I'm an instructor down at the art center that I actually started taking instruction from in the 1990s. So I'm now teaching down there, and have a lot of connections and a lot of friends in the art world. So there are days when I decide that I don't want to write, that I'll go down.
I was just going to ask, do you find sometimes there's an internal mental battle between, you know, the art, the writing, the art?
Yeah, there is. Actually, my husband is the one that puts more pressure on me than I do. He really likes the way I paint. I paint with palette knives, a lot with palette knives, but you can't tell it's palette knife. Because a lot of times with palette knife, you get a lot of hard edges, and it's really hard for the eyes to understand what they're seeing, because you're always constantly stopping and starting, and I don't do that. I make myself use a palette knife in a way that, you know, I'm very, very conscious of all the edges that I'm using. And my husband is the one's like, why don't you go down and paint? No, I want to write today. You know? So a constant thing like that. And, and I do commissions. So, you know, like, there will be times when I will be paid to paint somebody's painting because they want the specific thing. And, you know, they're contracting with me, so I have to have that done in a specific time. Yeah. So then it is, you know, you got to go down and paint. And there are times when I'm like walking down to the studio to paint going, I really rather write. I really rather write, but I'm getting paid for this, so I better go down and paint. But yeah, so it's fun. I mean, if that's the worst thing that happens in my day, I'm living a pretty good life.
I suppose before we move into our next topic, but sort of as a way of getting there, I suppose I'll ask the same question on the art, you know, in general, the art world, how technology and the internet has influenced that over the past couple of decades.
But, you know, it's interesting.
Do I get the impression it's maybe not quite as much as for writing and for authors, publishing?
It isn't, in the standpoint, you know, that I don't know. You know, there's this internal battle that's kind of happening with me right now. When you ask the question, I think the probably the worst thing that it has done, in two ways of talking that is it puts pressure on the artist to get out in the market sooner. So early on, and there's a saying that you have to paint miles, thousands of miles of canvas before you actually reach your voice. Okay. And it's probably
in
the same
sense as well, I suppose, of, you know, I always tell authors, you know, look, you're going to become famous on the first book. Sometimes it takes three or four books to really start establishing yourself. And I guess it's the same way in all areas of creative life.
Yeah. I mean, I basically just went through my studio about a year and a half ago and took an X-Acto knife and ripped through paintings that I never wanted anybody to see. And those were my beginning paintings, okay, which I was out marketing. And now, looking where my art is and looking back at those paintings, I never should have been out there that early. I should have just sat there and studied and painted. And then kind of like hit the market with where I am now. And so that's kind of a watch out that I try to tell my students is, you know, if you're doing this on your Facebook account and it's family and friends, good for you, not a problem. But if you're going to go out and try to market, you know, you need to be painting every day. You need to be, refining everything. You need to be out there learning from the master artists that are out there. One of the things that I also encourage my students to do is to do a study of a past master, because you learn so much trying to copy what they're doing. I also tell them they're not allowed to sell that, and they're not allowed to enter it into anything. And, you know, that's their personal copy. But you do learn a lot that way. And you can compare that to authors reading other authors' work, you know, and how they handle it.
I have to ask the question, because you mentioned it there, in a creative sense, talking about, you know, going through all the old canvases and taking the X-Acto knife and saying, what the hell was I thinking then? Do you do that with manuscripts as well, you know, that you wrote 2-3 decades ago?
Yeah, I have a stack of my first book is like this. Yeah. Well, I can't get my hands up. There was about 12 inches stack of scenes that I had, and those were all handwritten at the time because we didn't have the word processors, the computers, mm-hmm. and I hated typing on the old typewriters. Yeah. So, you know, I handwritten a lot of things, and I have a stack of that sitting in a drawer in the other room. And part of me is like, you know, that was my first book. It took me 12 years to write because I was working at Procter & Gamble, yeah. and I can't throw it away because it took a lot of writing, but I can't stand reading it either. So I keep wondering why I have it.
So for now, I'm going to leave it where it is, you know, propping up the missing leg on a couch.
Exactly. It's hidden in a drawer for a reason.
It's still not coming out. It's taking space
over. Yeah. When I move, if I move from Ohio to somewhere else, I'm not particularly sure I'm going to keep it.
So let's move on to our final topic then today. You and I really, as so many of my guests, met through social media, mm-hmm. and much of our discussion, you know, isn't just around authorship and publishing. A lot of it has been around the media and politics. I suppose we're at that stage of the program where we and of course this is something reflected as well in your work, mm-hmm. the fiction you write. It's been a strange 2 or 3 years, hasn't it, in American
political history?
Yeah, it sure has. It's it really helps when I write, when I go back into the 1980s and the 90s, and I look at, you know, a lot of folks are saying we've never been this divided, you know, we haven't been this divided since the Civil War. And I kind of question that, because every time I go back into history, I keep finding how the left doesn't seem to want to work with the right, or vice versa. Point the finger wherever you want, but mm-hmm. there's always been a lot of decisiveness, and there's always been a lot of competition. And you know, history does a great, great thing, because it cleans up a lot of stuff, and a lot of that stuff we tend to forget. And you know, it was very divisive back in the 80s between the right and the left, and you know, what we should be doing. And in a way, that tug between the two of them is a good thing. What I see different between then and now is the ability for people to reach beyond that divisiveness to reach compromise and negotiation. You know, obstruction has been one of the key words that everybody's been using.
To be fair, we have to keep reminding ourselves, look, you know, obstruction isn't just here now with the Democrats, you know, it was there as well, you know, when
with the Republicans,
President Obama's administration was there with the, you know, so it works both ways. And also historically, we've seen it. We're certainly seeing much more divisiveness now than perhaps we previously seen. I mean, a lot of people felt there was going to be an awful lot of divisiveness at the time. I think Ronald Reagan became president, but he seems to have had that gift very quickly of mastering both, you know, main political parties and getting them to work together, which is something that we're not seeing. And there's no encouraging signs that we're seeing that. And I suppose the question is, you know, how do we change that? How can we change that?
Good luck.
That's the end of that.
The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who resigned really quickly. I'm in his district. Okay. And while he was Speaker of the House, I was not a fan of John Boehner. But since he has left and he's actually started speaking out about how bad it was and how bad it is, you know, I'm kind of sitting there like he came back on. There was an article written on the healthcare vote, and he says you're never going to get anybody to agree. That it's the bottom line. And it's like, you know, this is a guy who was inside, and probably the reason why he left was I've had enough of this. I don't want to deal with it anymore. You know, the parties can't align, and he couldn't get them to align. And you know, I'm not really sure. It's going to take some people jettisoning the ego and basically saying, you know, we got to do this. We got to get together. And I haven't seen a lot of politicians that I've been really, really hopeful for lately to kind of do that reach across the aisle. But there's one or two or three out there that I think are coming up now that realize that they have to do that. And I'm talking younger generations, not the older folks. You know, there's a couple young ones out there that I think are know that they have to start doing this and really starting to change that. So.
One of the
it's
things,
going to take a while.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me, and I follow this, obviously, like so many of us, fascinated. You know, you don't even have to be a citizen of the United States to have been fascinated by following this whole process over the last 2 or 3 years. Well, one thing that struck me was, and I have a reasonably good knowledge of American politics, certainly modern American politics.
Yeah.
And I remember when we went through the process of the Republican Party's nomination, you know, and we had those, what was it, 17, I think, at one stage.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, I consider myself more I don't want to say a Democrat, because I'm not, like, I don't live in, you know, in my country and other countries, there isn't such a Republican Democrat, you know, it's our boxes, you know, that parties, you know, particularly in the European system, tend to work. Even multiple parties tend to be able to work together, and the process is much easier after an election when all the sort of chips fall into place. And one thing I found was, there I am, I remember one evening, and it was one of the debates, the Republican debates, and it was at an early stage. And I think pretty much if there wasn't 17, there was like 14 or 12 of them still standing, as it were.
Still too many.
Yeah, still too many. And well, we'll talk about that in a second when we get to the Democrat side. And it struck me, am I developing some sort of mental disorder? And I'm looking at the TV and I thought, what are you doing, Mick? That's Rand Paul. You're nodding. Stop it. Stop nodding. And particularly in the recent year, and God knows, you know, he's had his significant health issue recently. And there I am nodding with people like John McCain. And I'm nodding at things that even Lindsey Graham says, how crazy is this? And I'm going, what kind of surreal universe am I in, you know?
Right.
And, you know, it's just like... That's the most difficult thing I found. And as you say, you're right. I think 17, I think when perhaps you can suggest I'm wrong. I think when Donald Trump threw his hat in the ring, I think the Republican Party panicked and thought, oh my God, okay, how do we deal with this? And they just threw the kitchen sink at it. Let's get as many people in here to try and water it all down. It'll be fine. We'll get through this. You know, he'll drop out after two or three of them. And it didn't happen. And I remember thinking to myself, as this all went on, and somebody asked me, who do you think the best one? I thought, well, you know, it's fairly clear that, you know, little Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, you know, it's clearly, you know, that they're be very quickly coming out as the front runners. And I said, but you know what? I have a terrible sinking feeling they're not. I actually think Donald Trump is going to win the Republican nomination. He's tapped into something that the rest of them just cannot see and are not picking up on. And it's just it's just a load of infighting. And they were like Skittles just knocking each other over.
Right.
Sorry,
yeah,
I went on there. You're
No, that's... No, very similar to yours. I, you know, it was this whole, I blame the reality TV mentality, okay? And he tapped into that. He knows how to work that very, very well. I don't watch reality TV except for the news. And and the reason why I said it that way was basically because I really do think that a lot of the news channels like CNN and MSNBC and a number of them have really gotten into the talking heads, make it reality. We have to shout at one another instead of just, you know, debate
it's
what's
transcending
going on.
Into politics, or it's reflecting politics, whatever way you want to look at it. But I think one is as much
one is
an
reflecting
influence as the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we are, no matter where you live, across the ocean or here or wherever, you know, life is pretty busy right now. And entertainment is key. It is a shutdown point of, you know, I just want to be entertained type of thing. And I think that enters into it a little bit too. But it's definitely this reality TV mentality that everything has to be so dramatic and everything has to be so, you know, much of a production. And that has really ramped up, I think, in the last 10 years. And so, yeah, so there was a part of me that was, like, really hoping that he would not get in, and he did. And we're having fun with Korea right now, North Korea. So that's going to be kind of an interesting thing to see how, you know, what happens with that. Hopefully I'll be here to listen to this when it goes out on your air, Mick.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, you know, somebody's going to have to start reining in the horse a little bit here, and I don't think anybody's really capable.
I don't see anybody there. I don't yeah. see it in Paul Ryan. I don't see it in any senior, you know, member of that. Okay, we've had the kind of the Rand Pauls, the John McCain, the people that are would now be politically now kind of considered on the edge.
The
more moderate sort of voices, or at least occupying that stage, you know, I think 4 or 5 years ago, what, you're Rand Paul moderate, John McCain moderate, you know, maybe they are now.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting too, because, like, if you look through history, if we go back to the beginning of America, you know, we had the Whigs, and then you had John Adams, who was, you know, more of a Federalist, I think I got that right. I haven't gone back. I'm not really schooled in history that much, but what I'm getting to is, throughout the history of our political systems, we have had Whigs, Federalists, we've had Jefferson, Republicans, we've had, you know, Democrats. So, you know, are we at a point where maybe the GOP party is starting to split into two different factions? Maybe we'll have three political parties after this. One, you know, America has never done very well at having more than two major political parties throughout all of its history.
And even traditionally, what we might call broadly speaking in America, you know, I know we did have a sort of what was it called? Like a liberal you know, and I know kind of like everybody sort of forgets that, you know, there was actually more than, you know, two candidates in this. And equally then I go right back to the 1980s? I can't even remember. It was the 1980s or the 1990s. I think it was the very late 1980s, one of the elections where we had Ross Perot.
That was the Clinton-Bush in 92.
Probably of all the third-standing candidates seemed to resonate. In fact, I would almost argue he was kind of like an early version of the Trump businessman.
Yes, he was.
You know,
he was.
Kind of way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, always
without
hear
the reality TV mastery.
Well, he had a little bit of that. He had a couple catchphrases he kept going back to all the time. But even so, I mean, basically what happened, you know, in that time period was when you get a third contender running like that is pooling. They tend to either pull from one party or the other. I mean, the Republicans will argue that Perot took some of George Bush's votes, so he ended up with, you know, electing Clinton because that vote got taken from Bush. So, yeah, I mean, you always have people arguing about that. But typically, and it was right around that time in 1992, the Democrats were the ones that had the large field because the incumbent was George H.W. Bush. And there was, you know, Bob Kerry from Nebraska, Bill Clinton. I mean, there was a whole slew of folks that were running. And I was, Bill Bradley from New Jersey was running. And I remember right after that, after Bill Clinton was elected, I remember, and I, to this day I keep thinking, was I dreaming? But Bob Kerry and Bill Bradley talked about forming a separate party, more of a centrist party.
Yeah.
That would end up pulling in some Republicans and pulling in some Democrats. And I remember hearing about that, thinking, oh, great, we're going to have three parties. We have a centrist, we'll have a left and a right. And you know, I keep wondering what would have happened if that had happened in 1992, because certainly you can see that faction in the Republican Party of, you know, the Tea Partiers that are in there, and then, you know, the old school Republicans, the grand old party Republicans that are in there. And you keep, I keep waiting for that party to split off. And I think if something like that happened, there may be some very, you know, right-leaning Democrats that would end up being in that party, because they're fiscally want to be more, identify more with the Republicans than they do with the Democrats there. So I certainly in 1992 through 95, 96 saw that that faction very much existed. And in that, I remember Kerry and Bradley talking about, you know, that they had talked to McCain about forming this party because they felt he was somebody that should, that could have come into that party and recruited some of the Republicans to go in there. But it, you know, it comes down to money. You know, they would have been walking away from a very strong at that point Republican Party with no money coming with them. At the same time, enter into the mix, you know, the Gordon Norquists and the Koch brothers and all that really started to become more entrenched in the process with a lot of money being infused into a party. Not saying that that didn't happen on the Democratic side. It certainly did.
Yeah.
You know, you, on both sides, you have a lot of money going into that that particular party and a lot of favors being bought.
Well, if you suppose that that takes us to three candidates, three recognized candidates. We had O'Malley, Sanders and Clinton, Hillary Clinton. What happened on the Democratic side? What are your thoughts? Where did it go wrong? Was it always going to go wrong? Did they take their eye off the ball? Was it a case of there were too many hardline people in the Democratic Party who simply would not entertain and put any weight behind another reasonable candidate? Or was there more outside influences, or is it just the whole Trump thing that he tapped into, or is it a whole mix of that, that he tapped into, you know, the disaffected part of the population that maybe hadn't voted before or had voted before but done it with heavy hearts?
Yeah, I think there's a faction of people out there who actually really do believe that the government should be run by business. I think there's one part of that. Okay, it should be run as a business. It's a, and I, obviously I am not one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that was one of the cries. Let's get a businessman in there. Let's see if he can run it like a business. Not going to happen. It's, you know, this is a government. This isn't business. And then there's a, you know, you had to look at. Let's look at 1990. It was Clinton versus Bush.
Mm.
And then in 2000 we had another Bush, W. You know,
Bush,
and
yeah.
then we ended up with Obama, which was a bit of a change. But you still had that undergrowing thing of, you know, we're spending too much on healthcare and we're doing too much on these other things and
mm-hmm.
business, you know, it really should be run as a business. So I think part of that, you know, art of the deal, if you will,
yeah.
with Trump was, look at me, I'm a businessman, I can make America,
I can fix it,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, I can fix it. I think anybody who has any political background or has studied any government knew that that, you know, wasn't going to happen. But
mm-hmm.
And I think when we ended up with Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee, we were back into, don't we have anybody else? And I think that Bernie did an excellent job of energizing a base that the Democratic Party didn't know how to deal
with.
The younger generations. And, you know, I think a lot of the Democrats were hoping that Hillary would tap into a woman's vote, that the women would get out and vote. But, you know, quite honestly, I don't vote on a person because of color or gender or whatever. You know, it, to me, it's what are you standing for? What's the platform that you're putting out there? Are you going to do the things that I think need to be done? And I'm not saying that I have the answer to that, but I need to hear what you're going to say. And that's, you know, I do it on more on data than I do on personality or gender or race or anything like that. And I can honestly tell you the day that I went to vote, I was entering the polls with tears in my eyes because I knew that she wasn't going to win. I mean, before I cast the vote, I knew who was going to win. And that was very upsetting. It was a very upsetting day. And, you know, it's like the Democrats celebrating a healthcare vote. I sit there and laugh and go, you guys haven't done anything. You know, it's not, let's, the GOP imploded. Let's not go and take a lot of credit that look what we did. We stopped healthcare. You didn't come up with your own bill.
Alternative,
You didn't come up and say, okay, this is how we're going to fix, you know, the Affordable Care Act. So let's be smart here. And, you know, there's a lot of fault on both parties at this point. One is not leading and has an opportunity to step out as a leader and is not doing it, is, in my opinion, failing miserably at doing that. So, you know, I can blame the right as much as I can blame the left at what is going on.
And I suppose on the Republican side, it's that, you know, belief that, look, we won both houses. We won the electoral
vote. Basically, we're not going to, you're okay. You just sit there, boys and girls. We don't need your help. And it's now beginning, I would like to think, we'd all like to think, it's beginning to dawn on them that, you know, you can try and fix the numbers so it goes down to 51 votes now, but ultimately you don't have the numbers to do this totally on your own, or you're going to get nothing done in 4 years.
Right. And you have some very, again, egotistical and proud leaders in those positions of majority leader in the Senate who absolutely does feel that he can some way swindle his way into these victories. I mean, we're seeing, you know, a lot of, I think if you look back behind what just the news presents to you, you're seeing a lot of incriminating things going on. I mean, the Constitution was always supposed to be flexible, but at some point I always wonder how much flexibility it actually has. Yeah. And they're testing that to a large degree. Yeah. So, you know, I kind of sit here and hold my breath, like just one more little bend. Let's see if we can make it, you know, make it not work.
I suppose looking at the future, is it going to be the full 4 years, do you think, with Donald Trump? Or will ultimately, as we say, will the constitutional bend eventually reach a point and snap and some, even a small amount of, and that's all it would take, a small amount of people in the Republican Party are going to step forward and say, enough's enough. We, you know, it doesn't look like it's certainly coming towards the midterms.
Yeah, we had this kind of a conversation before. A lot of people think, oh, in 6 months he'll be gone, or in seven or eight months he'll be gone.
Even impeachment doesn't work that way.
Yeah, impeachment doesn't work that way. I mean, we're looking at, I mean, it took 2 years in Watergate. Yeah, it's no different here. It's going to be 2 years here before they actually get to the point where they can actually, you know, start with
the
impeachment.
I'd nearly argue it's like a marathon runner who keeps looking at the lion. And although he knows how much more energy he's got, and it's just saying, you know, if I can get another 20 yards, I'll still fall over that line. And I think that's where Trump is at the moment. He's thinking, if I can get another, just somehow get another 6 to 9 months out of this, I don't care what happens, because by the time it does happen, I'll have done my 4 years, and then I can say, hey, you know, I did it, told you.
Yeah, right. You know, I'm not interested in this anymore. Yeah. I think if it, I think a lot of it comes down to how much he really starts taunting North Korea.
We're in a dangerous place at the moment, the last couple of days.
Yeah, and you know, if he keeps this up, I think it's going to be, you know, hey, we just can't deal with that.
Yeah.
That I think he needs to be. If anything makes him be removed, I think that would be it. And actually, if anybody dies over this, I mean, you know, they don't have to come to our West Coast to hurt us. I mean, the conversation that they're starting now with striking Guam is that is a big strike. I mean, that would hurt because that's our spearhead into that area. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't be doing this. So, I mean, and I just sit there and go, are we in Dr. Strangelove? When's Shu from Wag the Dog going to show up? Yeah. You know, so now we're in this military thing. And, you know, if anybody hasn't seen Wag the Dog, they need to watch that. So, because, I mean, there are times when I just keep going, well, bring out old Shu. Write a song for old Shu, you know. So, and then all of a sudden I turned around. I came back from art class yesterday, and this whole North Korea thing blew up when I was in art class teaching, and came back and I'm like reading Facebook. I saw your tweet, your fake tweets that you put out, and I'm like,
I still get the extraordinary, which just says the presence of time that we're in. Right. I still get 50% of people asking me, he didn't really say that is fake, isn't it, or is that real? And I'm saying, Gino, it's really sad when you have to ask me that. That's where we are now. That's how sad mm-hmm. this is. I can in a fake tweet say anything and put words in the president of the United States, and 50% of my social media audience will ask themselves, my God, he said that, I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Maybe I can. Maybe he did say that. Oh my God. I don't know whether he did or didn't. What's real? Mm-hmm. What isn't real? And that really was an experiment I started 12 months ago. And I continue it now because it still becomes fascinating. And sometimes I create one of those fake tweets in the evening in reflection maybe of what's happened that day. And I frighten myself then when I go and I look at real Donald Trump and I look at the 6 a.m. tweets the following morning and I go, I could have written that for him. That's virtually some of the same words that I've used, and that's what's frightening in the world we're living in now.
Well, actually, you know, he follows you on Facebook and Twitter, and he's actually just, oh, look, my friend Nick said this. So now
that must be, I better say that as well.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, it's I don't know. You could always do the thing of, if I were his chief of staff, what would I be doing? Type of conversations. Yeah. And one of the things is I would be paying, you know, hide his phone. If I could get it out of his hands, he would never get it back. That would be one thing. I think it's really, really sad. There was this air of respect and I mean, you could talk about it probably more than I can with being from Ireland originally and now living in Amsterdam. Yeah. You know, it's the United States was the country that a lot of people looked up to. Even, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, we still had that, even though there was a lot of divisiveness and stuff that was going on, we had leaders that were leaders.
And as I touched on earlier, he's not my politics. I don't agree with an awful lot of what he might have done as president, but I still have tremendous respect for some of the things that Ronald Reagan did and the manner in which he dealt with, perhaps not in his second 4 years. I think by then we ultimately historically now know that, you know, that there were health issues there arising, you know, but any president as a foreign person, you know, living abroad, watching this, you know, for most presidents, regardless, you know, I have respect for them and their office, and I listen to what they say. I'll consider what they say. But I just have no respect for this president.
Because I don't either.
I can't have respect for somebody who does not respect the office in which they sit and does not respect the office of the other people and expects loyalty over respect for their office. That's untenable to me.
Right. Yeah, I so agree. And, you know, part of the thing, I think we're getting a really big lesson here on why you don't run a government like a business.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you in business, it's okay for you to try and take out your competition. You don't have a lot of allies in a business. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of companies working hand in hand together, but you have a lot of nations that work hand to hand together, and you have the whole intelligence community and ticking off the intelligence community, you know, to the point where they're saying they're not going to share intel with the United States. Well, you need to wake up, folks, because you know what? We aren't the best and the brightest in the intel unit industry, you know, a nation by itself. It's all of us working together and piecing that jigsaw puzzle together. You know, I always said to a lot of folks is you don't want to mess with the Mossad. You never want to mess with the Mossad. You know, they do a lot of the stuff that we legally can't do because we've restricted our CIA through bills and acts and amendments and things like that. But, you know, a lot of the other intelligence agencies aren't restricted in that certain way. So it's kind of interesting from that standpoint that, you know, the first thing he did was tick off folks to the point where they didn't want to share intelligence with us, which hampers our ability to, A, help them, and, B, hampers us here at home.
Well, exactly,
with protection.
The five eyes become one eye, the Cyclops.
Exactly. So hopefully that's all being worked, you know, at the level that it needs to be worked and out of and kept out of the Oval Office, which is something that I would have said shouldn't be done, you know, just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like, hopefully he's not really leading this. Hopefully these other people are leading it, you know. He really puts to test that, you know, strong central government versus state government versus, you know, other entities governing, but he puts that argument to test for sure. So
absolutely. Well, let's try and end up on a positive note that that ultimately in the coming months people from both parties will get more of a backbone, stand up, and if we have to have the remaining term of President Trump, let's hope that it can be a hell of a lot more positive and less chaotic than it has been up till now. If not, this is not going to end well for any of us.
Exactly. One of the things that I remember, I wrote an open letter, which is out on my blog, to Sherrod Brown, who's my senator in Ohio, one of my senators in Ohio. And I basically, it was like the 2 days or 3 days after Trump was voted in. And one of the things that I said to him was, you know, you have to understand, you know, and I think he does because he's a very bright guy, that the seat of power isn't just the executive branch, that actually the legislative branch is and the Senate upper house is where a lot of the power sits. You know, they have the ability to remove a leader. They have the ability to, you know, make laws. So as much as Trump is there, they could isolate him and they could still get things done if they had the plan and the ability to reach across the aisle and negotiate and compromise on both sides. And that's kind of like the letter that I wrote to Sherrod Brown. And I took a lot of solace in the fact that, you know, we do have checks and balances. And as long as we had checks and balances, hopefully we'll get through these next 4 years. And that's kind of where I was. Now, I don't feel all that secure right this second, but hopefully, you know, hearing people stepping up and basically saying, you know, you're unhinged, you shouldn't be saying these things, and that's the body of power that should be saying that, is saying that. So it's from that standpoint, the checks and balances at this point are still working, and hopefully we'll continue to do so.
Hopefully. Yep. Linda Riesenberg-Feisler, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I think we've covered a lot there.
Yeah, we have, actually. We left out the Gene Roddenberry story, but that's okay.
Let's finish very quickly. Let's finish on Gene. Yeah. A nice upbeat. Let's push the Trump train out of the station. Gene Roddenberry, come on in. Tell you.
Yeah,
I forgot about this. I wanted to talk about this. So very quickly, let's give me the Gene Roddenberry story.
The only reason why I said it is because I brought the letter up.
I see. Very good.
So what happened was I wrote a script for Star Trek The Next Generation, and I was this brash young kid, and I decided that I was going to send it out to them to make a show out of.
Yeah.
So I decided that I was going to send it registered mail to Gene Roddenberry. And I did, and Gene walked down from his office and signed the little green piece of paper that came back to me that said that they received the script.
Yeah.
And then about two months later or so, I got a letter back, and it actually was from Eric Stillwell. So anybody who's a big Star Trek Next Generation fan, you will know who Eric Stillwell is. Mm-hmm. He kind of took over for Gene Roddenberry on that series. And Eric gave me everything I needed to resubmit my rejected script the proper way. I mean, inside this envelope, there is three sheets of papers with agents' names circled on them that he suggested I should call.
Yeah.
I mean, it went on. Well, being 20 some years old at the time, I read it as, oh yeah, well, it's rejected. I guess I can't write.
Yeah, it's a rejection,
I threw it away.
Oh,
I didn't.
Boy.
So basically, I was down in my studio painting one day, and I ran across this, and I opened the thing up, and I'm reading the letter from Eric, which was a very positive letter. And enclosed, please find the agent's names that I want you to contact, and here's the submission line, so change the scripts this way. And I was just, I just walked over and started hitting my head against the wall that I did not follow up with that. So I ended up, that's what really pushed me to get my first book out there self-published. So that's that story.
Well, that's the story. Linda, it's been a pleasure, and I'm always delighted to have you on again. God knows what we'll be discussing then.
Yeah, I'd love to come back on, Mick. Thanks for the invitation for this video,
so. No problem. We'll say goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye, everyone.
Okay, thank you for joining me on the program. Great pleasure to talk to Linda. We'll be with you again shortly, maybe a few more weeks. I'm on vacation for a couple of weeks. We should be back in maybe early September, maybe the second week in September. And I'm hoping to have an update on Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 then. Again, I hope you've enjoyed the program. Check all our links wherever you see this video podcast or podcast itself, iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you see it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Provided in this podcast production. Thank you for your support. Radio Espial. We explore and discover together.